This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. If you've seen the movie Shaun of the Dead, I probably don't have to tell you much about Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. That 2004 zombie send-up gave the English comedy pair a cult following that grew with their follow-up movie Hot Fuzz, about a gung-ho London cop who's transferred to a sleepy English village. Both those films were directed by their friend Edgar Wright, who also made the visually innovative film Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. Now Pegg, Frost, and Edgar Wright have reunited for a third time in the new movie The World's End. All three films were co-written by Wright and Simon Pegg. Pegg and Frost have continued to build their own careers in between their collaborations with Wright. Pegg appeared in two Mission Impossible films and two recent Star Trek movies, and Frost had roles in the films Attack the Block and Snow White and the Huntsman. They also co-wrote and starred in the sci-fi comedy Paul, which featured Seth Rogen as a pot-smoking alien. Their new film, The World's End, is about five old high school friends who reunite to finish a pub crawl they started 20 years before. When they get to their old town, very strange things happen. Here's a scene early in the film when Simon Pegg's character Gary, a heavy-drinking perpetual adolescent, is trying to persuade Nick Frost's character Andy, now a respectable teetotaling lawyer, to join his old mates for another go at the pubs of their youth.
We had ourselves a little idea.
As you know.
Yeah, we're going to go back to Newton Haven.
Why?
For some unfinished business.
That's a joke, right?
Five guys, 12 pubs, 50 pints.
60 pints.
Oh, steady on you, Alky.
I haven't had a drink for 16 years, Gary.
You must be thirsty, then. But we can go back, see the guys, chew the fat, it'll be just like it always was. Except this time, we are going to finish this thing once and for all.
You have a very selective memory, Gary.
Thanks.
You remember the Friday nights. I remember the Monday mornings.
Yeah, that's why we're going back on a Friday.
Why do you think none of us live in Newton Haven anymore?
I don't know.
Because it is a black hole. It's boring. It always was and it always will be.
It's only boring because we're not there.
It's pointless arguing with you.
Exactly. So come.
And that is Nick Frost and Simon Pegg from their new film, The World's End. Gentlemen, welcome to Fresh Air.
Nice
Thank
to be
you
here.
For having us, David.
Simon Pegg, let's talk about your character here. You know, you've played a lot of roles where you're really likable. Here, you're – well, maybe, why don't you describe this guy, Gary? He's a little intimidating.
Yeah, he's a kind of obnoxious and not entirely sympathetic. He's you know, he's this guy who had the greatest night of his life in June 1990 and has never, ever matched it. Which, when you think about it, is rather tragic. He sort of says it in a sort of celebratory way at the beginning, like, never got better than that. When, in actual fact, that is the mark of someone who has no happiness in his present. And that's why he's so desperate to get back there and recreate the night with his friends, because in a way he's trying to recreate the circumstances in which he was last truly happy.
You know, the director Edgar Wright says that this film and the other ones that you've done together a lot of the fun of them is taking people's perceived stereotypes of the United Kingdom and turning them on their heads. How does that work in this film, in The World's End?
We've always been very keen to not set our films in picture postcard England. You know, there is usually in a movie when you cut to the UK, you'll hear a little bit of Rule Britannia and you'll see a red bus go by. And Big Ben will strike.
It'll be snowing.
It'll be snowing, and someone will step off the Millennium Wheel, of the London Eye. It's it was important to us to set our films in the real England, in the real places where we grew up, the suburbs of London, not London itself, and the little village that, you know, Edgar grew up in, and these garden cities that we created Newton Haven from. But we also adopt certain stereotypical aspects of British life, because, you know, stereotypes, there's a reason they are stereotypes. And the big one has been the pub as a centre for, you know, as a sort of social nexus, which it very much is in the UK. The pub is an important place in many ways, not just to drink. It's a you know, the word pub is short for public house, and that's what very much what the feel of these places is. It's a sort of communal space. I get the feeling here in the US, you know, bars are places I imagine people sitting up at the bar, talking to the barman, drinking, usually alone. They're places where you go to imbibe alcohol.
It's a place a gumshoe might go to drink two fingers of whiskey.
Exactly. whereas the pub is a different dynamic, and... you know, after we did Hot Fuzz and we'd shot a few scenes in pubs, Edgar actually said to our producer, Nara, I never want to shoot in a pub again. And his next film featured 12.
12 pubs, yes.
What a hypocrite. That's kind of our thing. We don't want to be transatlantic with our movies in terms of, we don't assume the American audience have to be talked down to in any way or soft-soaped or given some kind of chocolate box version of what they're seeing, because... I think Shaun of the Dead proved to us that we could be resolutely British and it would still work over here. In fact, it would work because of that. You know, a lot of films who want to get an American distribution deal will put stuff in specifically to try and secure that, and that ends up just feeling fake. And
it dilutes, I think, the thing that people liked about us in the first place, you know.
Yeah, so we're kind of, we don't trade on our ethnicity, but we also don't lie about
it. We didn't hide it, you know. We are British. We're British filmmakers.
One of the fun things is that when these guys go back 20 years later to the pubs that they remembered, these distinctive pubs of their childhood, they've changed. Do you want to describe kind of what's happened to the pubs of their school days?
Yeah, well, one of the ideas about that came through in the writing of the film was this idea, and it's an idea that we've always sort of been interested in, this the notion of homogenization, of losing identity to something else. That happens in Shaun of the Dead, it happens in Hot Fuzz, and it happens on a grand scale in this. And often when you return to your hometown, the place where you grew up, it'll feel very similar but very different. And one of those differences is usually that the high street has changed. And of late, you know, the high streets have all become like small Londons. You know, the big chains have moved in, your McDonald's and your Starbucks, And this is happening in to the pubs as well. They're being bought up by chains and sort of recreated as little folksy meeting places, when in actual fact they're sort of, you know, brand specific, homogenized corporate entities that don't really have any character.
Right. They seem sterile and identical, really. I mean,
also, you know, I mean, alcohol in pubs is so heavily taxed by the Chancellor that it essentially gentrifies a pub, and I think something which, you know, in a system of class like we have in Britain, I always think that a pub is a classless place. You know, you can get a labourer or a bricklayer standing next to a lord and having a pint. You know, I think that's the great thing about British pubs. And now, because it is so expensive to drink in a pub, people aren't drinking in pubs.
Now it's just lords.
Now it's just the lords, which is very boring. The pubs stink of wax jackets and pink corduroys. You know, I think it drives the working man away from a place where we met to meet friends and you know, family.
I want to get to when you first met. Nick, you were working in a restaurant, right? And just who wants to tell the story?
Yeah, well, we'll both chime in. But I was working at a Mexican restaurant called Chiquito's. In a place called Cricklewood in North London.
Look for it, it's still there.
It's still there, yeah. And I, you know, I met this girl called Charlotte, who was Simon's girlfriend at the time, and, you know, me and her got on really, really well, and she said she had this boyfriend who was a comedian, and
you fancied her a bit, didn't you? And you were disappointed that she had a boyfriend, which was me.
Yeah, I kind of hated you. I hated the idea of you. Because it's always a nice, attractive thing when girls laugh at you.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, I always say, you know, looks fade, but funny's forever.
Tell my wife that. she arranged a kind of meeting for us, and it coincided with a big party that I was having at my house. And so Charlotte was going to come after work and bring Simon.
That was the girl.
That was the cow. I was quite nervous, actually, to meet him. And because, you know, it's that thing, a lot had been built up about the two of us. Oh, you guys are really going to get on.
And it was so, like a blind date. Wasn't
it was
it?
Like,
it really
a, blind
was like a blind date.
And so I remember them. I can actually see them now walking in, and me not making an effort to go over until I was ready. And then there was a time a bit later on when he was outside on my balcony, and I kind of went over. And I remember us kind of kind of skirting around one another, and there was a, like, we did impressions and stuff, didn't we?
Basically, we got on really well, and I took Nick out to a couple of comedy gigs, and he came to see me, and I got him ready for his, helped him get ready for his first comedy gig, and which was a sort of open mic night at a club called the Cosmic Comedy Club in Fulham in London, which he was great at. I think I still have it on VHS somewhere. That is going on YouTube. And then we hung out a lot.
Put it up with a book.
Yeah, we hung out. I realized we'd hung out almost every day for like a month at one point, and I thought, I've only just met this guy, and I'm absolutely relishing his company, and and that's how it happened. And eventually I broke up with Charlotte, and Nick and I got Nick, thank God. and our friendship endured.
After you met, I know that you, Simon, you brought Nick Frost into the TV series you were doing called Spaced, which has a real cult following. You want to just quickly describe what your characters were?
Basically, Nick had a character called Mike Watt, who was a reservist, what we call the Territorial Army in the UK, sort of weapons nut, slightly unhinged, but completely harmless, lovely kind of character, which he used to do for myself and Charlotte, just as a bit in the pub or whatever. And I was really interested in, I felt like Nick was the funniest person I'd ever met, and I was a comic. I all my friends were comedians, and no one was funnier than this guy who wasn't a comic. And so I asked Nick if he wouldn't mind if I appropriated that character for the sitcom for Jessica and Hines and I, who wrote Spaced, if we could have Mike and insert him into the story, and and would you play it? And Nick was sort of because he just thought might as well. He said yes, and so we took it to the network with Nick already attached, and sort of said, okay, we've got this sitcom. This is what we'd like to do. We have this actor who we'd like to play these parts.
This waiter.
I mean, actor. and they went along with it. I think partly because there was another Nick Frost who was in the union, our sort of SAG, which is called Equity, and they just assumed it was him. And like by sheer ballsiness, I guess, Nick joined the cast of this sitcom and his life took a different turn. So it was amazing, really, to look back. I mean, Edgar even said to me, are you sure this is a good idea? This guy's never acted before. And you initially weren't a huge fan of it, were you? I mean, of acting.
No. Well, I just wasn't... I'd never done it before, I'd never acted before. So it was, it was like My Fair Lady, but with a big fat man. My Fat Lady. We'd go riding on a bike and I'd sit on his crossbar.
The first time he ever finished a scene, I said, by George, I think he's got it.
Yeah. I'd like a white parasol that I'd flick out.
But he soon became like, Edgar, as soon as he started working, Edgar just fell in love with him and was like, thrilled. And so when Shaun of the Dead became a possibility, when we had the chance to make our own film, and Nick and I had this pre-existing relationship which seemed to work very well on screen, the idea for the film seemed the obvious thing to shape it around myself and Nick as the main characters, and that's how Shaun happened. And obviously that film, which we didn't know would get a release in the UK, let alone in the US, changed everything.
Right. Well, why don't we move to that, and let's hear a clip from Shaun of the Dead. This was in 2004. And Simon, you play a guy who's sort of adrift in London, works in an appliance store. His girlfriend wants something more, breaks up with him at the beginning of the film. And Nick, you're his buddy Ed, who's kind of crude, fun-loving guy. And then there's a zombie attack where
the classic story, though.
Yeah, it's a tale as old as time.
Yes, and of course you hear on the telly that if you hit the destroy the zombies' brains, that will kill them. And this is a clip where the outbreak has started. Also, if a zombie bites you, you're going to turn into one, so you don't want to be bitten. And Simon, your character, character, Sean, is in your flat. The two of you are in your apartment, and you're going to call your girlfriend, Liz, who's just broken up with you, but instead you've accidentally dialed your mom, who lives with her husband, Philip. Let's listen.
Liz!
Sean!
Mom, hi. I was going to call you. Are you okay?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, are you sure?
Some men tried to get into the house.
Well, are they still there?
I'm not sure. We've shut the curtains.
Well, did you try the police?
Well, I thought about it.
Well, are you okay? Did they hurt you?
No, I'm fine. I'm fine.
Mum?
Well, they were a bit bitey.
Mum, have you been bitten?
No, but Philip has.
Oh, okay. Has she been bitten?
No, Philip has.
Oh, okay. Listen, Mum, what sort of state is he in?
Oh, he's fine. Bit under the weather.
I see. What's the deal? We may have to kill my stepdad. Listen, Mum, sit tight, okay? You're not safe there. We're coming over.
I don't want to cause a fuss.
We're coming to get you, Barbara.
And that is our guests, Dick Frost and Simon Pegg, in the Edgar Wright film Shaun of the Dead. And we have to say that was Penelope Wilton there, the mom, who found the men a bit bitey.
Yes.
This is so much fun because you're just playing on – I think it was David Edelstein wrote afterward that the English have this inexhaustible wellspring of comedy, bestial urges and excellent manners. You know, we hear her – you know, don't mind me, but the world is coming to an end. It's just such great fun.
And also, we had this idea that even amidst the apocalypse, the minutiae of day-to-day life just doesn't change. You know, that's kind of what Shaun of the Dead is about. He's trying to save his relationship amid a zombie apocalypse, despite the fact that it's happening. And he still doesn't get on with his girlfriend's friends, and his relationship with his stepdad is still problematic, even though... In some respects, the zombie apocalypse sort of catalyzes a resolution there, albeit a tragic one. But that was also something very interesting to us, that we wanted to make the kind of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead of the zombie world, and have this strange little the side story happening in the Romero universe, this, you know, the great zombie films that George Romero created. And he created that whole mythology as well. The whole modern zombie was basically George's doing. Mm-hmm. You know, he combined old sort of voodoo stories and this sort of slight cannibal fad there was in the late 60s, and he created this, you know, cannibalistic modern zombie, which is all his idea. And I think shows like The Walking Dead and Shaun of the Dead and anything really post George owes him a huge debt of gratitude, because, I mean, Shaun and The Walking Dead are essentially just George's idea taken on in a different direction, you know.
There is a lot of action here. I mean, in this film, you're whacking zombies all the time. You killed Bill Nye a couple of times. this continues in the other movies and in the new one. There's a lot of action sequences. Does it get harder to do as you get older?
It's funny, actually. I think the amount of action in each film has increased as we've got older.
I think you just have to, you know, it's also what the role needs. You know exactly what you need to do physically and the shape you need to be in to be able to do these. You know, one of these fights in World's End took 8 days to shoot. You know, and you're fighting for 11 or 12 hours a day for 8 days. You know, so it's. I never made a movie like a movie in my an action movie in my 20s, so I have nothing to compare it to be honest. But it just, you know, it's always a nice thing when you go home and you're bruised and you've been punching stuntmen all day, and it's a good pain. And it's that kind of pain where you just feel like you've perhaps spent the day digging a big hole or knocking a wall down.
Well, we have to talk about Hot Fuzz. It's the other film in the trilogy that you both did with Edgar Wright. This was in 2007. Simon, you want to just talk a little bit about the idea here? A brilliant London cop exiled to a quiet English village.
Yeah, Hot Fuzz was Edgar's idea in the inception. He kind of liked the prospect of doing an action film set in the UK with British police officers, because they're not particularly cinematically cool. You know, they sort of wear sweaters and carry sticks. And in cinematic terms, they're not particularly romantic. And we'd had this idea about a very, very accomplished London police officer who is reassigned to a small hamlet in rural England because he's so good, he's kind of messing the figures up in London. And we wanted this clash of parochial British policing and sort of Michael Bay style action. And we wanted the film to start off very much as a sort of Miss Marple, kind of Agatha Christie, bucolic, kind of very, very, very English set crime thriller. And it become this extraordinary high-octane action flick.
Let's hear a clip from Hot Fuzz. I mean, this is where the two of you, you know, Simon, you're this London cop who's in this quiet village, and Nick, you're playing his partner, Danny Butterman, who's the son of the inspector, and you're sitting in the patrol car, and Nick's character, Danny, is munching on an ice cream. The scene begins when he asks his partner if he wants something from the snack shop. Let's listen.
Want anything from the shop?
You've just been to the shop.
Thinking of a different shop.
Constable Butterman, this is not the time for personal errands.
Well, there's nothing going on, is there?
There is always something going on. You have to look closer, all right? What about this guy?
Mr. Treacher?
Yeah, why has he got that big coat on? Can't be cold. Why the extra layer? Maybe he's trying to hide something.
Mr. Treacher?
Okay, what about this guy? Ask yourself, why has he got his hat pulled down like that?
He's ugly.
Or he doesn't want you to see his face.
Because he's ugly.
Okay, what's his story?
Oh, it's Lurch.
Go on.
It's a trolley boy at the local supermarket.
Good.
Real name Michael Armstrong.
Uh-huh.
Dad says he's got a child's mind.
Okay.
Lives up Summer Street with his mum and his sister.
And are they as big as he is?
Who?
The mum and the sister.
Same person.
And that's our guest Simon Pegg and Nick Frost in the 2007 film Hot Fuzz. I love that line, same person.
Dad says he's got a child's mind.
That really makes me and Simon laugh.
I think it's the hee-haw joke. I mean, that's the classic thing. When you get to the countryside, everyone's related. Maybe a little bit more than they should be.
Right.
But we couldn't resist it.
You know, people describe Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and the new one, The World's End, as a trilogy because it's the two of you and your director, Edgar Wright. Did you conceive of it as a trilogy, and is there more coming?
No, we didn't. Absolutely not. I think it would be arrogant and untruthful to say that we ever did. Arrogant, I think, at the time, because it would assume that we were going to make three films. And, you know, at the time of Shaun of the Dead, we just wanted to get that film made. We didn't know if we'd ever get to make another film again. So it was just about that. When we made Hot Fuzz, and we realized that we could make a sort of thematic sequel to Shaun of the Dead, not a direct one, but one that at least kind of displayed similar approaches, addressed similar themes. We were dealing with protracted adolescence again. We were looking at the notion of loss of identity, the struggle of the individual against the collective. There's a deeper connection to the films that I think is really easy to trace when you watch them together. And if you watch them apart, it really doesn't matter. We will make more films together, I have no doubt, but they won't necessarily have to abide by that criteria. They could be something completely different to what we've done before, which would be a nice, change.
Nick Frost and Simon Pegg star in the new movie, The World's End. You can listen to a longer version of our conversation online at freshair.npr.org. Robin Thicke is a singer whose single Blurred Line seems to be the pop hit of the summer. And yes, he is the son of TV sitcom star Alan Thicke. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Robin Thicke's new album, also called Blurred Lines, and some thoughts on a controversy surrounding the single. Everybody get up.
Robin Thicke exudes a kind of oily charm that is, with the right material, by no means off-putting. A prime example is the song that led off this review. Blurred Lines gives you the complete Robin Thicke experience. The song is a come-on, because basically all Thicke does in his music is try to put the make on women. What prevents him from being too creepy is that he's also genial, even gentlemanly and debonair, when the object of his lust shoots him down. Sometimes his songs sound like parodies of hip-hop, of the sort Andy Samberg does with his pals in The Lonely Island, as on this Thicke song, For the Rest of My Life. Finally convince you to come over and just say hi. I'll say forever, my lady, and kiss you for the very first time. After months, holidays, holding hands in the park. Normally I just play basketball or something in the park. And I messed up like boys tend to do. It'd be a year till I got back with you. Thank God that you called me back, baby. 'Cause I'd never be the man that I am today. For the rest of my life, you know. Listen and look past his roué image, and Robin Thicke is revealed as an earnest nostalgist. He persistently makes music that harks back to the Quiet Storm soul and disco of the 70s and 80s. He's a smirky but sincere curator of the old sounds he loves, straining to approximate the croons of vocalists such as Peebo Bryson, Frankie Beverly, and Felipe Wynn. Blurred Lines album is, overall, a fetching pop collection, a dreamy make-out record. But it threatens to be overshadowed by Blurred Lines the single, which is a phenomenon that just keeps on inspiring cultural contradictions. The video for the song shows Thicke, producer Pharrell Williams, and the rapper T.I. surrounded by skimpily dressed young women who flit around the men and buzz away. Some people were offended by this. Now there's a question about the song's provenance. Specifically, think of the percolating rhythm of Marvin Gaye's 1977 song, Got to Give It Up. Now listen to a bit more of Blurred Lines. Last week, it was announced that Thicke's legal team is doing some preemptive work. They're suing Marvin Gaye's estate to prevent any potential lawsuit over the similarities between Blurred Lines and Got to Give It Up. For good measure, Thicke's team included the 1974 funkadelic song Sexy Ways in the suit just in case, even as author George Clinton has already said he has nothing against Thicke's song. Now, when it comes to filching melodies and hooks, I give pop music a lot of slack. Whenever someone wants to yell sonic plagiarism, I get this image in my mind of Jimmy Page holding a stack of old blues guitar records and chuckling with a wily rasp. One thing pop music is tidy about is recycling. Robin Thicke is not only not going to cut into the sales of Marvin Gaye or funkadelic music. If anything, these songs are now going to be listened to by a generation that may not have heard the songs previously. As for Robin Thicke, well, he's a hard worker. He's been churning out songs for other acts, as well as himself, since the late 90s. And he's done it by blurring stylistic lines with a wink and a smile that just gets more sly, more knowing, with every release. Come on, let's go. Ain't nobody gonna get in my way. I'm gonna make it, no matter what you say.
Ken Tucker reviewed Robin Thicke's new album, Blurred Lines. Coming up, we talk with Sports Illustrated's David Epstein. His new book is The Sports Gene, Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We've all had the experience of watching a great athletic performance, a gymnast like Mary Lou Retton defying gravity, or Michael Jordan sinking a mind-blowing turnaround jumper, or Tiger Woods executing a seemingly impossible shot, and wondering, were they born with that talent, or can you get there with hard work and practice? Our guest, David Epstein, says scientists are learning a lot more about the role of genetics in athletic performance, and in his new book, he explores the subject in a number of ways, like whether big league hitters have naturally faster reflexes, whether some people are born with speed, and that delicate question, are blacks overall better athletes than whites? He finds that science now has answers, or at least insights, into all those questions. David Epstein is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. His new book is called The Sports Gene. David Epstein, welcome to Fresh Air. Your first chapter is called Beat by an Underhand Girl. This is a lovely story. Tell us what happened here.
Well, thanks for having me. And that first chapter is about Major League Baseball players who are in an exhibition facing Jenny Finch, who at the time was one of the world's greatest softball pitchers. And frankly, they sort of giggled their way up to bat against her because they figured, well, here comes this ball that's bigger than the one we're used to. Here's this woman who's throwing it underhand tosses, and it takes about the same time to get to them as a major league pitch does.
And they are hitting softballs, not hard balls, right? Yeah.
Indeed. She was pitching them softballs, exactly. And so they all felt like they would basically tee off on her and take batting practice, hit a couple balls out of the park. And it turned out that they couldn't even hit foul balls off of her, much less get any actual hits. And so it turned into actually a television show where this pitcher, Jenny Finch, would go around to major league camps and just whiff the best hitters in the world.
Right. And when you say the best hitters in the world, give us some names.
Well, Albert Pujols, who was the best hitter of a generation, is one of the first people that Jenny faced. And when I talked to Jenny Finch, she actually said that she was afraid that he would hit the ball right back at her, so they thought about putting a net in front of her before she did this. And then within about two pitches, she realized that he would never even get close to the ball. I mean, he was missing by a half a foot sometimes. Some of the major leaguers she was facing, Barry Bonds, they would swing and miss so hard they would spin around.
Right. So the best of the best, and they can't even make contact with her pitches. Now, there's a fascinating point that arises from this, and one of them kind of dispels the notion that these big league hitters are blessed with amazing reflexes. Turns out they aren't, right?
That's correct. That's what I thought. So going into it, I figured that they would have these sort of superhuman reaction speeds because they face 100-mile-per-hour pitches every day. And Jenny Finch's fastballs take exactly the same amount of time as a mid-90s baseball does. So the baseball comes from 60 feet and 6 inches at mid-95 miles an hour. Jenny Finch throws from 43 feet at about 65 miles an hour, same exact time. And the ball's bigger, and yet they couldn't hit it at all. It turns out that even the best hitters in the world have perfectly pedestrian reaction times. I actually scored better on a visual reaction time test than Albert Pujols did.
Okay, so it's not their reflexes, but there is an explanation. And what is it?
They pick up on cues from the player's body before their pitch. So for a pitcher, they're without knowing it, the hitters are actually focusing in on the motion of the pitcher's shoulder and the pitcher's torso and hand, and then as soon as the ball's released, on what's called the flicker, which is a flashing pattern that the red seams make as they rotate. And it's only picking up those anticipatory cues that allows a hitter to hit the ball, because the reaction time of major league hitters and teachers and lawyers and doctors to a visual stimulus is about 200 milliseconds. That's 1/5 of a second. That's half the total transit time of a fastball. We simply do not have a biological system that is capable of tracking objects moving at that speed. So once the ball is halfway to the hitter, he might as well close his eyes. He's already swinging wherever he's swinging. So in that first half of the pitch, right when the ball's out of the hand, the hitter has to have picked up cues from the pitcher's body and the movement of the ball to know where it's going ahead of time.
All right, so it's not that they're reacting more quickly. It's that they're reading the picture that they're seeing and anticipating where the ball's going to be. It's like it's the software, not the hardware, right?
Exactly, exactly. This is a learned perceptual skill. And in fact, if you do a digital simulation, which some scientists have done, where you delete the pitcher's shoulder, Albert Pujols becomes me, basically. You have to delete a little more than the shoulder to get him to that novice level, but he basically becomes a novice if you do that, and you can do the same thing with tennis players. The problem when he was facing Jenny Finch was that he didn't know this. He didn't know how he is able to hit a baseball. And Jenny Finch, her shoulder motion is completely different from a Major League Baseball player. The seams of the ball are completely different. The rotation of the ball is different. And so he was completely stripped of the anticipatory cues that would allow him to seem like he has superhuman reflexes.
You know, I remember reading Pete Rose's autobiography, and as a young kid, he was not a particularly outstanding athlete, but he taught himself to be a switch hitter and just practiced and practiced and practiced and got really, really good. And I guess this raises the question of sort of, is thousands of hours of training all you need to be a high-performing athlete? And in fact, one of the things you find that geneticists have discovered is that we don't all respond equally to training, right?
That's exactly right. In fact, that is sort of, more than anything, that's a message that's emerging from exercise genetics. When I looked back at older papers, and particularly in the sports psychology literature, the definition of talent that would be given in papers was basically skill that pre-exists any attempt to train. But now what genetics is teaching us is that the more important kind of talent is actually your biological setup to respond well to training, your ability to get more benefit from your 1 hour of training than your training partner's 1 hour of training. And that is emerging as the real talent.
You were a runner yourself, and you write about another runner who both of you trained really hard. You got a lot better, and he didn't, right? What was going on here?
Exactly. That was my college training partner, who was sort of a blue-chip recruit, whereas I was just a walk-on. And we became training partners, and he came into college and into our seasons in great shape and then sort of stagnated. And I would come in terrible shape. I mean, I went to a pulmonologist once, and his report said that my aerobic function was consistent with very early-stage emphysema. And then I'd start training, and it was like somebody had injected me with rocket fuel. I would do the same exact training as this training partner of mine, stride for stride, day after day, and I would improve every race, and he would stagnate. And what happened was that our teammates and coaches sort of foisted upon us two different narratives. For him, it was this talented guy who, was kind of a head case because he wasn't improving. And for me, I was this talentless walk-on who was so tough that I was improving. I even got this award in college for overcoming significant difficulty to achieve success. But later on, I had my genes test, and it turns out I have genes that predispose me to responding very well to aerobic exercise. And now looking back on it, it's clear to me we were doing the exact same thing. It's clear to me that I wasn't moving at faster pace than him because I was tougher. It's because I was responding to the training better.
And when you say you were responding, what's the physiology of it? What was happening in your body that was different?
So my aerobic capacity, for example, would go up very rapidly. I started with a low aerobic baseline, which is the amount of oxygen that I can use when I'm exercising. And as I would start to train, that would go up, and it would go up quickly. I mean, when I would go back to a pulmonologist, they would do tests on me and say, you know, it looked like I was cured of asthma, basically, because suddenly I could expel more air, and my endurance would get so much greater. Everything about me would respond. I would drop weight extremely quickly, much more easily when I started training compared to guys who were doing the exact same training that I was doing. And so that sort of won me this flattering narrative that I was the tough guy while my training partner was, struggling mentally even though he was talented.
Are there genetic traits that make us better at getting the software to perform well in a sport that help us to see a ball coming out of a pitcher's hand and recognize what it's going to do? Are there genetic differences in our ability, with practice to pick up the right kind of patterns?
Right, so if our sort of genetic setup is our hardware, and the software, the skills that we learn in as we train, there's sort of two different lines of evidence there. One is, yes, we are starting to find genes that speed the download of software for certain people. For example, there are genes associated with proteins in the brain, for example, and if people have a certain version, they learn motor skills more quickly and make less mistakes. That said, that picture is not totally clear on the genetic level. There are a lot of genes still left to be found because it turns out that genetics is just way more complicated than we thought it would be a decade ago when the human genome was sequenced. But there are innate traits that we know factor into that. So, for example, with a baseball player, they have baseball hitters in the major leagues have an average visual acuity of 20/12, which means they can see from 20 feet away what I would have to stand at 12 feet away to see. And that appears to be an innate quality. It's based on the density of cones in your eye, basically. It's like the megapixel rating on the digital camera that is your eye, and it doesn't really change. And so even though they're relying on learned perceptual cues, they are able to pick up those cues more quickly than the average person.
You write about somebody testing the vision of the Los Angeles Dodgers and Tommy Lasorda, the famous manager, wanting to know what good it was to him. What did he find out?
Well, yeah, so this Louis Rosenbaum, this scientist, he went to Dodger Town to do not just visual acuity, not just the sort of 20/20 test on baseball players, but also looking at depth perception, contrast sensitivity, all measures of visual skills. And Tommy Lasorda was sort of skeptical and asked him to, fine, if that works, then don't look at any of these minor leaguers' stats who are in our camp and just tell me who's going to be good based on just their visual test scores. And the first year, Dr. Rosenbaum picked Eric Karros, who then went on to become the Rookie of the Year and have a long, successful professional career. And Lasorda challenged him again the next year, and Rosenbaum picked out Mike Piazza. Mike Piazza had been drafted only as basically a favor to Piazza's father, who was a friend of Lasorda. Nobody expected him to do anything, and he went on to become the greatest hitting catcher of all time.
We're speaking with David Epstein. He is a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. He's looked at the genetics of athletic performance, and his new book is called The Sports Gene. One of the more sensitive questions that arises in any discussion of genetics and sports is whether African-Americans and Africans are better athletes than others. And one of the things that you write is that there's sort of an evolutionary explanation that might account for part of this. You want to explain that?
Well, most of our ancestry as humans has occurred in Africa. So people have been in Africa for far longer than they've been outside of Africa. So genes for hundreds of thousands of years were evolving, changing inside of Africa, and then just a tiny group of people, maybe no more than 150 people or a small group, left East Africa en route to populating the rest of the world. And at each stop, their genes changed to accommodate their environments and sometimes just by random chance. And so there hasn't been nearly as much time outside of Africa for a lot of genetic action to take place. What this means is that most of the genetic differences that have been built up in our history are all still in Africa. All of us outside of Africa are just tiny subsets of a tiny subset that left Africa. So if you got rid of everyone in the world outside of Africa, you would lose a little, but you would preserve most of the genetic variation for all of humanity.
Which means that those that are of the African gene pool have more diversity, which means you'd have some really, really fast people and some of the slower people. Maybe not an average difference, but more diversity?
That's correct. That could be. So, of course, we don't look for the slowest people. But you might find, at a particular trait, you might find the most diversity within an African population as opposed to comparing someone in an African population and someone in a European population. So you might find the fastest 10 runners and the slowest 10 runners. But nobody's looking for the slowest 10 runners.
Did you find when you spoke to a lot of geneticists and scientists as you researched the book, were they reluctant to talk about race and sports?
Reluctant would be an understatement. It almost scared me out of writing the book, to be honest. At the American College of Sports Medicine conference in San Francisco last year, actually the head of a kinesiology department at a major research university confessed to me that he was actually hiding data that he had on ethnic differences. And his study was about the response of exercisers to a dietary supplement. It had nothing to do with anything that I would consider taboo, and yet he was worried that by publishing it and conceding that there might be some biological ethnic differences, that somehow this could lead to speculation that there are also innate intellectual differences, as if the two had anything at all to do with one another. The problem is hiding data like that can, in this case, maybe not a big deal, but can be really – can and has been really dangerous, as I write in the book.
You know, if when I look at the book overall, it sort of seems to be asking the question, how much of athletics is nature and how much is nurture? And it seems like the answer is plenty of both.
The answer is plenty of both. So one of the things about the 10,000 hours rule is it's become shorthand for saying practice is important. And that is something that was never controversial among scientists. If we didn't believe practice was important, we could have athletes just show up on game day and nobody would have ever had to practice. But the job of scientists is to find out how important practice is exactly and how important it is in one sport compared to the next. And sort of as I go through in the book, I mean, in the chapter about NBA body types, right, it's, if you know an American man who's at least 7 feet tall between the ages of 20 and 40, there's a 17% chance he's in the NBA right now. So those genetics would be pretty darn important. But in some other sports, it's not quite that outlandish. And actually, in a way, it gets to your specialization question, because I think sometimes we sort of do a disservice by pushing every young athlete into trying the most popular sport. Whereas one thing that's clear from genetics is no two people respond to one type of training the same way. But it also looks like no two people don't respond to any type of training at all. So there is probably a training out there and a sport out there that people are better fit for. And I think we do well to sort of expose young athletes to the range of sports.
You know, it's obviously that someone who's very tall has an advantage at basketball. And if you're big and bulky, that gives you some advantages in certain football positions. Are there some sports at which the skills are simply more likely to be born with them?
Well, certainly in a high skill sport, any high skill sport, you're going to have to learn the skill. But if you think of basketball not only being tall, but jumping ability. And jumping ability is something you can improve, but it's also a function of the length and stiffness of your Achilles tendon. And you can make your Achilles tendon stiffer through training, but you can't lengthen it. So skills like that, absolutely, they're very important. Sort of innate qualities, even though you can improve them to a degree with training. In terms of the sports that we would call sort of more skill-centric, like golf and things like that, nobody's born knowing it. So as I wrote, one of the things that's often omitted from Tiger Woods' life story, where his father presented opportunities that allowed him to train furiously from a young age, is Tiger was able to balance on his father's palm at 6 months old, when most infants are just struggling even to stand. So I don't think that destined him necessarily to be a great golfer, but certainly allowed him to practice earlier so that he was hitting balls by the time he was 11 months old, and that's an advantage in itself.
David Epstein is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. His new book is called The Sports Gene. You'll find a longer version of our conversation online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Our assistant producer for online media is Molly C.B. Nesper. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.